on DAB Digital Radio, Digital TV, downloads and online.
This is 5 Live.
Credit Crunch Movies, Village of the Apes, we've had...
Oh, that's good.
with Nail.
But, okay, fine, yeah.
Self-catering apartment, Rwanda.
I'm not...
You don't like that one.
No, well, it...
Andrew sent this one on Twitter. Oh, brother, there you are. Which I quite... I don't know, see if that... Is that...
But why is that Credit
no
Crunch?
No idea, but
that's
it was quite
sequel,
funny.
That's a sequel, isn't it?
And Mitch Ben... Hello to Mitch, by the way. Also sent in Pan's Basement.
Very good.
Ryan Air Force One. Man Spider, did we do that? I quite
no.
like that one.
Man Spider?
Yeah.
Oh, I see, okay.
Tom, on this... emailed Top Cat and Officer Dibble, while sitting my Welsh Board AS Film Studies exam on Wednesday morning, I was asked to comment on a quote made by the good doctor himself regarding a Metro interview in June last year discussing critics and the fourth Indiana Jones movie.
Can I just say before you go on, I'm really glad because I was this was rumoured, this has been on Twitter as well, that apparently you and I turned up on an AS level film studies.
Yeah, no, it was just you. It's a quote from... a review you did for Indiana Jones, clearly. The rest of the paper, says Tom, asked for my social and political knowledge on two films of my choice from Thatcher's Britain, blah, 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 blah. Anyway, it was the fact that it was a quote from you which was the inspiration for one of these questions.
And what was the quote?
Ollie and Cliff Senn thought I'd get in contact to let you know the good doctor, to my great surprise, turned up in our film studies exam on Wednesday. In the question titled What Factors Decide the Success or Failure of a Film at the Box Office, Mark was used in the support text as an example of a critic being a possible partial factor. I used this opportunity of his inclusion to refer to the now legendary Pirates 3 rant and how hilarious it was. I just hope that the examiner agrees.
But what was I meant to have said? It quoted the Indiana Jones. I thought Indiana Jones was all right.
You were part of the support text.
I don't know, what does that mean?
I didn't take
support text sounds like a bit of sturdy undergarment.
Well, Ollie in Cliff's End is actually listening today rather than listening to the podcast, so I'm sure you can explain. Send us another email, Ollie, and more will be explained. Yeah. Or if you took that film studies thing and were surprised to see Dr. K there being referred to, you can get into
it. I only found out because I was going to school. I dropped the kids off at school and I was walking to the station and somebody I know said, oh yeah, I was invigilating an AS level thing yesterday and you were in it.
This from Marcus. Dear Doctors Frankenstein and Strangelove, was sitting in my local over here having a standard bar discussion of what sequel is better than the original, for example.
Godfather 2, better than Toy Godfather Story 1, 2.
And Empire is better than Star Wars. Yeah. And we noticed that...
Wrath of Khan is better than Star Trek as well.
We noticed if there was a third film in the series, it typically dropped the ball, usually by quite a bit. Spider-Man 3, for example.
Yeah.
So my question is this. Has there been a set of films that have got progressively better as the series continued? The only one that I would put forward, just to start the ball rolling, is the Bourne series, which I think would pass the test. Does The Good Doctor have any more? And by the way, he says, I've just watched a trailer for a film called Mega Shark versus Giant Octopus, which could be the greatest film of the year, but probably won't be.
I think High School Musical 3 is better than 1 and 2. I mean,
is 2 better than 1, though? Because you said before 2 is a bit of a...
No. It goes 1, then down to 2, then up to 3,
The whole point has to be 2 better than 1, 3 better than 2.
Oh, so each one has to be exponentially better.
Which works for Bourne?
Well, I mean, two. I think two and three, I think, are unfair. Would you think Bourne 3 is better than Bourne 2? I like both of them. They're both substantially better than Bourne 1 because they're both Greengrass.
In the Credit Crunch movies, by the way, Simon Dennis is suggesting the Bourne mediocrity.
Very good.
Which kind of...
$100 brain the Ken Russell
anyway,
movie.
Anyway, if there are any...
you didn't even hear that, did you?
One, two and three brain something.
The Ken Russell movie, $100 brain. Never mind.
Sex and the Village, suggested by Steve. And North by Northampton is another one from Wendy. Matt in Toronto. Dear Doctors, I know it's far off on the horizon, but with all the write-ups of must-see summer movies, I thought it vigilant to mention that I see what I see as The Perfect Storm, and it's Funny People by Judd... starring not only Seth Rogen, but Adam Sandler.
Oh, no.
I will let the good doctor speak for himself, but I already have a very good idea of what a challenge that would present. I already... in capital letters. Can't think of a more tortuous movie cast of people who push my buttons the wrong way. You can't push something the wrong way, though, can you? You just push it one way.
No, if something pushes your buttons, it can be in a good way.
I know that.
Yeah, so it can push your buttons in a bad way.
Wondering if any listeners have tales of perfect storms whereby all desired chances of critical objectivity are destroyed by two actors or a director coming together whom you know you can't stand. So a number of things up and running. The credit crunch movies, there's the sequels that are better progressively up to and including the third.
Yeah, and it has to be each one is better than the other one. It's not just that the third one is the best of the three.
Right.
Okay.
And also that one where you have a perfect storm of actors and directors together where you just know it's going to be unspeakably terrible, and funny people sounds as though it might be one of them.
Toxic Avenger 1, 2 and 3 do get better, but they start from a point of such abject awfulness that by the time it gets to 3 they've only acquired moderately terrible. So
it still fits, though, doesn't it?
It still fits, yeah. They're still all rubbish. I once interviewed Phoebe Legere, who was the one of the stars of the Toxic Avenger movies, and she was one of those people who went out of their way to appear kooky, therefore appearing completely ordinary. And I interviewed her in a hotel in Chelsea, and she was dressed in a tutu playing a piano accordion.
Very nice. DJ in Hampshire, dear Dr. Langdon and Camerlengo, would that be?
Well, you're Langdon, presumably.
I would imagine so. I'm going to listen to your show live today as opposed to via the podcast, as I am trembling in anticipation of the review for Angels and Demons. My mates are going to see it at the weekend, and when invited to join them, I refrained from giving a pithy response until later today, purely because I'm sure that the good doctor shall be providing me with a far more worthy pointed review at around 3:30, and I shall be able to shamelessly fob it off as my own work. I will have to admit to reading the book, which staggeringly made the Da Vinci Code look like a masterpiece. Please don't disappoint. Well, we're going to kind of build up to Angels. I'm not quite sure.
Have you seen it? Is it just me?
No, I haven't seen Angels.
Because you were going to come. I had a ticket for you. And in fact, I saved a seat for you.
Yes.
Almost halfway through the film, I was still saving the seat for you in case you turned up late.
I had work to do for this programme, I imagine.
Oh, and it wasn't work for me to sit through Angels and Demons.
No, you being the film reviewer and me not being the film reviewer, I think that was the crucial bit.
Okay,
and
you Tom still Hanks getting your name first on the Sony not appearing award.
Catherine, dear Captain and First Officer, thank you so much for your wonderful company during my 13-hour delayed home from work trip to Athens on Tuesday. This is news to
delayed us. Home from going home to Athens or coming home from Athens?
As we taxied away from the stand at 6:50, 50 minutes ahead of schedule, I hadn't imagined how much time the three of us were going to spend together. We didn't end up taking off until 8:15 the following morning.
No.
How lucky for me that my husband had kindly downloaded about 8 hours of podcasts. I worked my way through them from last week's backwards, just like the film flips. I shouted out the greetings along with the live Leeds audience and laughed out loud, seeming, I'm sure, to be slightly hysterical to my fellow passengers. I wanted to tell David Morrissey that I'd met him once on the set of Basic Instinct 3.
Two.
She says three. Yes, I know.
She means two.
How on earth did his agent persuade him to do that one? I know, he says three here. As I'd had an entertaining day as an extra on the film. Before you ask, I thought I'd bought it in a charity auction. So, just to warn you, should a woman bump into either of you in the not-too-distant future and ask, did you both get home from Athens okay, it'll be me.
Can I just say, if you were an extra on Basic Instinct 3, that person wasn't David Morrissey. That's clearly a straight-to-video production that has yet to hit the shelves. I'm sure you mean Basic Instinct 2, in which I think David Morrissey acquitted himself very well, and which featured the most memorable of erotic thriller lines, "She left early, how Lacanian of her."
Yes, which we
dissected at some length.
Yes. So what we'll do is we'll start the box office top 10. Just tell us, so we know it's Angels and Demons. What else are we going to be reviewing and previewing and getting excited about?
Fighting, as you said, you had the star of Fighting on
Channing
the show. We have a Synecdoche, New York, which is, it's funnily enough, it's now almost exactly a year ago that I saw Synecdoche, because I saw it in Cannes this time last year. It's taken a whole year for it finally to hit our screens. This is the movie which is directed and written by Charlie Kaufman, as opposed to just written by Charlie Kaufman. We also have Viva, which is a pastiche of a 70s sex comedy, allegedly in the mould of Russ Meyer movies, although I don't remember Russ Meyer movies being quite like that. And that's your lot.
So that's coming up. Thank you for all the credit crunch movies, of which a huge tome has just arrived. But we need to sift through them.
But a vast number of them appear to be taking movies with exotic names and just putting the names of British places in it. Why is North by Northampton necessarily credit crunch? What's wrong with Northampton?
It just sounds cheaper.
Yes.
North by Northwest sounds as though it might cost more than North by Northampton.
Lord of the Ring?
We've already had that.
Have you?
So we're just going to... We'll stagger our way through the first couple of numbers here. Fast and Furious is this number 10.
Start at number 8 because number 10 and number 9 I haven't seen. Fast and Furious and I Love You Man, neither of those have I seen because they came out the week I was off. But may I take this opportunity to just say very quickly, In the Loop, which isn't in the charts, is still playing. And if you were Amanda Iannucci, with everything that's going on at the moment, with the venality and crassness of politics at its most rampaging high, wouldn't you just be sitting back going, was there a better time to release In the Loop ever in the history of Western civilization?
There is an email somewhere which I wish I'd got to, which used the word venality and crassness in the first sentence and said, please use this at the beginning of your review slot so that Mark has to find other words to describe the current situation in politics.
No, I have to keep using it because I was told off by Alistair Campbell for saying venal and crass, and consequently I'm going to say it again
all the time.
And again and again.
Now look, it's okay. Before we start that, loads and loads of people have mentioned the fact, and I think it was just because you weren't on at the time. They want to know what you think of Let the Right One In. Dave Morrissey mentioned it as his favourite movie of the year.
Fine.
And I think you were off that particular week.
I was.
So we have 60 seconds for you to tell us about Let the Right One In.
It's directed by Thomas Alfredson, and it is, for my money, the best film I've seen this year. Funnily enough, many people saw it last year. It played at Fright Fest. It's a Swedish movie, Swedish vampire movie. There is no tradition of Swedish vampires, to be honest. I interviewed Thomas Alfredson for The Observer. It was one of those things in which on the one level, it's a vampire story. On the other hand, it owes something to Stand By Me. It's a coming-of-age movie. It's a sort of urban realist movie. It's moderate, recent past period movie. It's one of those things when, like all truly great horror films, when they come so out of left field that you just weren't expecting them at all. I mean, it left me breathless. I've now seen it 3 times. I genuinely thought, you know, I wasn't prepared for it in exactly the same way that I wasn't prepared for Pan's Labyrinth, and I would be really, really surprised if we see a better film than that this year. And the real shame was it should have been Sweden's entry for the Oscar. Due to its release date, they said it had been released too late, so they put Everlasting Moments out. But I think it may, perversely, be eligible for next year, but see it now.
I hope that's put the record straight. Coming up next, the top 8, and then we'll build up to Angels and Demons, shaking with anticipation already. You're looking at me as though you're expecting something very exciting?
Well, just your usual wit and... No, I was just...
No, okay. I thought there was something I was supposed to do at that point.
No, I was just looking
this
at you.
This is award-winning conversation, this is. Absolutely.
I wonder how he holds it together so well.
Monsters versus... So Fast and Furious at 10. Man is at number 9. Monsters versus Aliens this week's number 8.
Fine, passable, forgettable, 3D. Okay.
17 again at 7.
Zac Efron is, you know, lots of fun on screen. This is not a hugely fun movie, but it's okay largely because of him. But there is it's not his best work. High School Musical 3 is still the best thing he's done.
State of Play at 6.
Well, this is the ongoing, should we see the TV production or should we see the movie? I do think the movie as a standalone piece is good fun. I mean, Russell Crowe in fat boy acting mode, therefore being serious. Very, very little for Ben. What?
No, I was just remembering, I saw the DVD of the TV, because this came up in conversation, £5 in a well-known store for the whole lot.
For the whole lot.
The whole TV 6 hours, which has got to be fantastic.
It is, and you won't get somebody in front of you on a mobile phone talking to somebody and, you know, complaining about how the plot doesn't quite add up. I mean, I like State of Play, the movie, but it is just a disposable thriller, whereas I think there was more going on in the TV thing. And I see that the thing that David Morrissey said here on the programme has been quoted very widely. Like, he said he hasn't gone to see the film because it'd be like going to the wedding of a girlfriend you were still in love with.
It's a beautiful line.
It was great, wasn't it? David Morrissey.
And hello, Jason Isaacs, our favourite person from this week, who gave up his pudding to come in and present us with a little...
You gave up his main course, Simon. Thing.
Main course?
Yeah, it was a real Oliver...
Did he go back and have his pudding?
No, I went back in the car with him somewhere else. He was off doing something else. Yeah, no, it was the greater love hath no man that he should give up his food.
And hello to Fairport Convention, all of whom rang up earlier to say well done on that thing.
Oh, did they? Great.
The Ghosts of Girlfriend's Past is at 5. I looked at the poster and
Mr.
I thought,
Mahogany,
the poster is so terrible. It's almost, I think someone, it was a Twitterer pointing, it's almost as though that the graphic designers had given up.
Yeah, they don't
thought,
care.
I can't even make this thing look vaguely attractive.
But it is basically a film of him leaning against somebody in a jovial way with that smile on his face. I have to say, as the Matthew Mahogany stuff goes, it's not one of the worst. There are a couple of moments in it that raise moderate titters, largely due to Michael Douglas playing a kind of slightly accentuated version of himself as a fabulous the old roué goes, but other than that, it is rubbish.
And hello to Michael Sheen as well, because he didn't get included in that list. And Stephen Fry,
yes,
of course. We need him back. It's been a long time
we
since
do.
He was on the show. Hannah Montana, the movie, is at number four.
You know, I clearly appear to be the person who's not, who doesn't think that Hannah Montana is as sinister as everybody else. When Stephen Fry was on, he referred to its star as Smiley Virus, which I hadn't heard before, but I am now going to use ad infinitum.
X-Men Origins Wolverines at three.
And many emails saying a Wolverine is not a dog.
So, no, that's because the early tweet feed from you was...
It's a dog
Wolverine,
of a movie.
It's a dog of a movie.
Yeah.
Now, it's Coraline at number two.
Ah.
Dear Dr. Spock and McCoy, my fiancé Joss says Rob Eggington, MNG, PhD, pending corrections. My fiancé Joss and I went to see Coraline in 3D last night. First off, great film. The main things I liked about the book were in there. And the changes felt in keeping with Gaiman's original creepy story. However, the extra £4 for the glasses aside, even before the end of the 3D adverts, Up and Jonas Brothers.
In 3D.
Our eyes were hurting. Any fast movement was hard to follow, and when the 3D did work, it took you out of the movie experience. This is a very stylish film and didn't need the gimmick of 3D to show that. Now, I will admit that both of us need glasses, so it may be that our ocular systems are just substandard, but we certainly won't be bothering with 3D again.
Can I just say, it is true that if you are like me in later years and your eyesight is not quite what it was, the 3D experience is slightly more headachy. Certainly if you wear glasses or contact lenses, they haven't solved that problem yet. I've had a couple of emails to the website from people saying, I'm colorblind, does 3D work? Because the polarized version did, the old version of 3D doesn't. But I am yet to be convinced that it is necessary that 3D really is the future of cinema. I still think it's mainly an anti-piracy thing. Of course, the other main topic of conversation with Coraline is whether or not it's too scary for kids. I mean, I said it's a good, fun kids movie. You know, it's creepy in a way that kids will enjoy. A couple of reviews from last week said, terrifying, terrifying, will terrify adults and children alike. Terrifying, how can it be so terrifying? I'd be interested to know if anybody took their kids and their kids did genuinely find it too terrifying. I don't think it is. It's scary in a way that a good kids movie should be, and I refer to what I said last week about Dougal and the Blue Cat has very scary moments in it in exactly the way that children's films should have scary moments.
I must
Grimm's
have missed
Fairy
those.
Tales. No, but that's because you were just being really difficult about that film. And if you saw it again with a more open mind, you'd really realise that it was a great piece of work.
Trust me, I'm never going to see it again. Mm. Matt Rook, just wanted to say I saw Coraline by Status Quo in plain old 2D, and it was amazing. It's so funny. Even if you can't get to see the 3D, it is a must-see. And fancy doing a show from the Electric Cinema in Birmingham. It's the UK's oldest working cinema, so it's got to be worth a visit.
Well, I mean, I have to say that the defaulting to 2D is starting to appeal. I mean, and it's funny because Up has just played at Cannes. I mean, everyone's going, I saw a big news piece the other day, oh, start of the 3D revolution. Well, it's kind of, well, you're a bit behind the game there. And I really don't think it's going to happen. I mean, I can imagine this tape being played to me in 10 years' time when everything's in 3D and holographic. But of course, Henry Selick has already said that he thinks the future isn't 3D cinema, it's holographic cinema.
Heavens. Do you need to have anything
extra? No, I think...
I mean, imagine what they're going to charge for that. You'll need an entire seat, you know, whole bandstand to yourself. So it can, the whole holographic thing can appear in front of you. That's not going to work. Okay, so where are we? So Coraline's at two. Star Trek's at number one. So a whole bunch of correspondence on Star Trek before we move on.
Peter Positive, I hope it.
Well, shall we work our way through it? Peter in Sheffield. I saw Star Trek last weekend, was dumbfounded by the irony at the beginning of the film. It seems clear to me that Starfleet is a projection of the American Western myth of redemptive violence, which is exactly what everyone was saying at the cinema on Saturday.
It was.
You could hear them nudging each other and making just that very point. We heard it stated near the beginning that Starfleet is peacekeeping and humanitarian, and yet, here's the irony, Kirk's father was a suicide bomber. To see a starship flying into the heart of the enemy's civilization is an image pretty close to the bone, isn't it? What do you think?
Good point. It reminded me of that thing in... Do you remember that record by the firm Star Trekking across
yes.
the... Which had two gags in it. One of them was, we come in peace, shoot to kill that. But the other one, which was the funniest bit, was the bit with the guy doing the impression of Bones going, it's worse than that, he's dead, Jim. Did you know, incidentally, that the firm were formed by the guitarist of the Rubettes on an off day?
Really?
Tony Thorpe. Yeah, it is true. That's what he did. He was the guitarist of the Rubettes, and then he went off and he did Arthur Daly, he's all right, and Star Trekking.
Simon Mark says, Kurt van der Bach, I am a regular podcast listener. I used my iron will to save up fresh podcasts of your film review show this spring so I could listen while running the Prague and Berlin half marathons.
Wow.
I'm just writing to point out to Mark that the Star Trek tune, which you were... should start with an ascending minor seventh, the same interval as the beginning of There's a Place for Us. And not an octave, as Mark has been singing. The octave comes in the second phrase. I know this.
Oh, yes, he's right. Here we go. Here we go. Fine. First verse. Do,
ascending minor seventh.
Yes. Do, da. And then in the second verse. Do, da. That's the octave. There we go.
Right.
You don't get that from everyone.
You could turn that into a Dodge Brothers routine. But probably shouldn't.
Well, of course, Star Trek was originally it was wagon train in space. So,
dear Bones and Scotty, says David and Daventry. David in Daventry just saw Star Trek at Cineworld in Northampton last night. Very enjoyable. As someone who never warmed to the numerous spin-off series, particularly liked the nice references to the early show cliches: Kirk with a green woman, Scotty giving her everything she's got—that's the ship, not the green woman—and a marvelously crotchety Dr. McCoy. Plus the inclusion of Captain Christopher Pike. And I think when you go and see it, if you haven't seen it already, everyone has to do that bit, which was mentioned by a listener last week, which was as Captain Pike is being tortured, you have to say, "Don't tell him, Pike," because he's being tortured.
There's also another brilliant Star Trek thing, old Star Trek cliche in that a load of them get into a pod, and it's three people you recognise and one person you haven't heard of before who's got dead meat stamped on it. Do you remember that? It was always when they beam down the planet. Let's bring, you know, Captain Blong. He'll step out
in a different coloured shirt. There's a whole Eddie Izzard routine based on this, which was extremely well
observed. But it's actually in the film. It's fantastic. It's the guy, you know, there we go, fine. No one knows who he is. Let's just have him done with.
Marion Crom says, thoroughly enjoyed Star Trek, but just had one issue with the film. Kirk's father at the beginning of the film looks strangely like Mark's impression of René Hamster staring at the sun, Zellweger. This distracted me for the first few minutes of the film, and I feel it's Mark's fault, so I didn't enjoy the first few moments. Phil Rennie just emerged from Star Trek. I have to say, I'm going to agree with many of the Good Doctor's comments, especially those regarding the extremely Trek-like reinvention manoeuvre. I'm sending this, though, to point out something even more galling than paying for 3D glasses. Yeah. I'd like to highlight my local Dingiplex's worst price gouge. Jump to establishing backstory. I hardly visit the cinema due to the ridiculously small legroom, regularly shaky projection and easy jet seating. But on this occasion, I splashed out an extra pound, a small increase on the luxury £8 ticket price, for a premiere seat, and managed the whole film without feeling like a stroll halfway through. But why is even comfort now considered to be additional to being allowed to watch a film? I'm supposed to enjoy the films, am I not? Star Trek was great, but I'll continue to boldly sit at home with a projector and surround sound while the trade-off for screen size and additional dimensions is possible DVT.
I agree.
Live
entirely.
Long and prosper.
Absolutely.
So that's all the correspondence done and the top 10. I think we're building up to Angels or Demons. We're not going to get to it yet. So what might we do first while we're filling
in? Should we do Synecdoche Nickdicky?
Okay, so Philip Seymour Hoffman.
The Philip Seymour, yes, but it's actually called Synecdoche.
Yeah, but it stars Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Yeah, but there is a title. I mean, I know it sounds unlikely that Philip Seymour Hoffman movies would need anything other than that, but in this case, the title is pretty much everything. Synecdoche, New York.
The latest film from Philip Seymour Hoffman.
No, the latest film with Philip Seymour Hoffman from Charlie Kaufman. It is un film de Charlie Kaufman avec Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Does it?
Il nome Synecdoche, New York.
So people follow some of this guff on Twitter. You just follow it in at Wood Entertainment. And someone was pointing out this week that Angels and Demons is not in cinemas. The advertising says it's at cinemas. And wondering whether that's so. What
well,
you,
I think
you
that,
go
that,
in and it's just sort of there in a role.
But that's a kind of that's a critical point. Is that it is an at you film? It is a film which is hello, you're really stupid. Let me explain to you what's going on. Just sit there. You can't possibly understand that we're in the Vatican. The Vatican. It's the head of the Catholic Church. Heard of that? Right. Snap up. Pay attention.
Philip
so it is at cinemas.
Okay, it's at cinemas rather than in. David in Gerlach, and he admits he nicked it from. I'm sorry, I haven't a clue.
Yeah.
For the credit crunch movies, those magnificent men in their sewing machines. Which you have to say is class. Bingo Royale from Martin in Astro.
That's very good. No, that's very good.
Catherine, we read Catherine's email out earlier about Basic Instinct 3. She said, I meant Basic Instinct 2. I'm still recovering from the overnight delay. And Ollie and Cliff send, this is about your appearance in their AS level film studies. By the support text, I meant the accompanying booklet with the exam question, which gave few examples in which we should refer to.
In which we should refer to?
Or at which
we should be referred. Yes, and you most definitely should be referred.
There's some new stuff coming out, and here's one of them.
Well, let's do Synecdoche.
Is this with Philip Seymour Hoffman?
It is, and it's almost a year ago now that I saw the film, almost exactly a year ago, because it played at Cannes, and it's written and directed by Charlie Kaufman. As you probably know, Charlie Kaufman is a great screenwriter. He's written things like Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, which he worked with Michel Gondry, which for my money was the best film of that year. And it was a really peculiar thing in which after doing that, Gondry kind of went out on his own and made some movies on his own. And I interviewed him a couple of times for the Culture Show, and I remember Gondry saying that he felt that his work was better when it was done on his own because it was pure undiluted him. And that obviously if you work with anybody else, if it was a collaboration, what you did was you took down the purity of the original vision, it turns into something else. So actually what he wanted to do is do everything himself. Of course, the end result was that the films that he made on his own, without the sort of the mediating influence of Charlie Kaufman, tended to be more impenetrable. Now, again, it wasn't that there wasn't anything interesting in them, because there was, but it just wasn't anything like as accessible as what happened in Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, which, of course, is an incredibly complicated story. I mean, Eternal Sunshine is very, it's like Total Recall done again and again and again. It's like a Hall of Mirrors story. It's about identity. It's about the breakdown of identity, about past, present, and future all coexisting, about having to forget things that you can't forget. It's a very complicated film, but very accessible. Now, the same thing has now happened with Charlie Kaufman, who did, I mean, being John Malkovich, I think is probably the thing he's, you know, he's best known for outside of Eternal Sunshine. But in the case of Synecdoche, he's made the movie himself, he's directed it himself. So he's not, you haven't got that tension between the two creative people behind it. And I think that the lack of tension is a problem. Now, in the case of Synecdoche, to give it a brief plot synopsis.
Can you just explain the title?
Well done, straight to the heart of the periphery. And you're absolutely right, okay.
When we went, like to disappoint.
When we went into the screening in Cannes, the whole question was, what does the title mean? How do you pronounce it? What does it mean? When we came out of the screening, the question was, what day of the week is it? And do we care any longer how you pronounce the title? There are two words. There's Schenectady, the place in New York, and there's the other word, which looks like it should be pronounced Synecdoche, which apparently, and correct me, I know we have several Oxbridge English professors listening every moment, is apparently a word which means a something which stands in for the a part which stands in for the whole. The example being
alongside the whole, or just instead of.
No. So if you say
outside of the whole,
if you refer to an army, you know, it's like, you know, 100 foot of whatever, or what was the somebody, oh, like a head of cattle, you know, or
what?
It's a small part of something that stands in for the whole of something. Can I have your daughter's hand in marriage? It doesn't mean you literally give me the bit with the four fingers and the thumb.
Right.
It means, you know what, if I'm having that, I might as well keep the rest of it.
If you can explain that in a slightly more succinct way, let's say in under a paragraph, mayo at bbc.co.uk.
I think hand of marriage was actually rather well done.
Well, we got there in the end.
Okay, so impenetrable and, I have to say, annoying title. In the, you know, how do you do blah, 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 blah. So the story is Philip Seymour Hoffman is a failing artist who very clearly standing in for Charlie Kaufman, having a midlife crisis, hasn't done the stuff he needs to do. You know, you interview Charlie Kaufman, you ask him about this, he said obviously most of what he does has an autobiographical element, because people in the end up writing about themselves. Even if you write about going to the moon, you end up writing about your own perception of going to the moon. So he's a failed artist. He gets given a grant, a genius grant, to put on a large work of art which is dedicated only to being truthful. And what he then does is he mounts a theatrical production which grows in scale until it takes over an entire apartment in which people are practicing a version of his life that effectively becomes so big that it takes over his life, and where reality ends and fiction begins kind of collapses and everything becomes a play and it's all a bit Pirandello, and, you know, we're all
just... there's a clip that's going to explain it.
No, there's no clip. There's no clip. And believe me, the clip wouldn't explain it any more than that, okay? So, you know that thing that Shakespeare says, all the world's a stage? Well, that's it, fine. That's it. That should have been the tagline. All the world's a stage, in this case, a very, very big warehouse. Now, the problem is this. It's not that Kaufman doesn't have some quite wonderful insights and some incredibly inventive turns of the imagination. It's not that Philip Seymour Hoffman isn't always worth watching on screen, as is Samantha Morton and many other members of the cast. It's not that there aren't some genuinely breathtaking moments, such as the moment with the dreamlike moment in which he suddenly believes that his daughter has disappeared off to another country and been tattooed, and the woman he's living with says everyone's tattooed, and suddenly demonstrates that she's tattooed from head to foot and he just hadn't noticed up until that point. It's not that none of those things are there. It's that you just don't care, because watching it is like wading through, you know, prac crit porridge. It is a film that absolutely required somebody to mediate Charlie Kaufman so that it's not just like being inside his head. It's like climbing. It's like doing a Being John Malkovich on Charlie Kaufman. It's like, in fact, a movie called Being Charlie Kaufman, in which you get into his brain and you're scrambled around for 2 and a bit hours. And unfortunately, what could Had it had another person in there saying, you can't do that, straighten that out, Roger Corman with a chainsaw, you need a helicopter there, you need a chase sequence here, and believe me, you can't go on. It descends so much into self-indulgence that the things that are good about it just get lost in the exhaustion of the film. And I say this with no great... but pleasure, because there are things in Synecdoche, New York, that I do think are really good. I really like Charlie Kaufman. I think at a time in which people are writing terribly formulaic Hollywood scripts, it's great to see somebody essentially, writing existential parables and doing so in a way which is witty and clever and inventive. And it also looks like a project of great love and a project which, if you went into it wanting to find a masterpiece in it, you might be able to do so. But I've seen it twice. The first time, I completely lost patience with it, and I really, really got fed up with it. The second time, I thought, what this needs is a fearsome editor. What this needs is a script doctor. What this needs is a producer with a big stick saying, that's very nice, Mr. Kaufman, now cut it in half and come back when you've taken out half the lines and it's half the length. Because all the good stuff gets lost in the waffle. As has so often been said... I invite people to finish this self-deprecating gag.
What kind of porridge?
What do you mean, what kind of porridge? Prat-crit porridge.
Yeah, what's that?
You know what practical criticism is?
I do.
Yeah.
What's that got to do with porridge?
Well, it was a mixed metaphor.
Oh, right.
It was the porridge of practical criticism. What's wrong with that? Actually, I'm very proud of that phrase. I'm going to use it again.
Porridge with toppings or not?
No. Prat-crit porridge. Prat-crit being you get shown something completely, you don't know what it is, and you have to say whether it's good or bad. Porridge as in stodgy, as in wading through porridge.
Can be light and fluffy, though. Very tasteful.
Name for me a light, fluffy and tasteful porridge, and you're not allowed to say ready break, it's not porridge.
The porridge that I have every morning.
Oh, what's that then?
It's light and
Angel
fluffy.
Angel Delight porridge. That's no. Not. Can I just say, Simon, Angel that's Delight not porridge. Porridge, that's just your wife being nice to you because you have, a children's dessert for breakfast, and she tells
that
you
it is?
That it's porridge. You're the person who's drinking Ribena and eating hip organic.
What's wrong with Ribena?
Oh, don't start.
So I have butterscotch whip for breakfast.
You do, yes.
Tim in Leicester, synecdoche.
Synecdoche.
Noun, a figure of speech in which a part of something is used to refer to or denote the whole thing.
Yes, it's what I said.
Or the whole to refer to or denote a part, e.g. the use of wiser heads to mean wiser people.
Okay, let me ask you.
In a sentence rather than a paragraph.
No, okay, we're trying to explain what this word synecdoche meant, and I said it's like it's when the part denotes the whole. Like, for example, if you ask for somebody's hand in marriage, you're not asking for their hand, you're asking for all of them, but you're referring to their hand. Did that make sense?
Yeah, figure
thank you
speech.
Very much. Thank you.
Yeah, but you took about 5 hours to get there. That's all.
And brought porridge into it.
Joe Van Giesen, lost somewhere in Georgia. I'm from New York, therefore I know the pronunciation of the town. Schenectady.
Yes, but the film isn't called Schenectady. The film is called Synecdoche, pronounced Synecdoche to rhyme with Schenectady. That's the whole point. And as I said, this phrase, there is allegedly a phrase which doctors use on their notepads, which is, DFK, DFC.
I've got a feeling I shouldn't ask.
Don't know and don't care. And it was that literally coming out of the film...
That's what you thought.
That's what you thought.
Now, look, we've got a couple of minutes, so let's not start Angels and Demons. Let's squeeze something most entertaining, which people might like or hate, just before the 3:30.
Can we do a very quick one?
Yeah, well, what
I can very quickly do you Viva.
Well, you've got 2 minutes.
Okay, Viva's not going to take...
How long do you need for that?
Well, I need more than I'm going to get if you don't stop talking.
You got a couple of minutes.
So Viva
is 2 minutes and 10 seconds.
A pastiche of a 70s sex comedy. The tagline for it, which I have here, is...
Is there a clip for
they were No, they were housewives seeking kicks in a world of swingers, orgies, booze and sin that was the sexual revolution. And it's directed by and stars Anna Biller. And it's one of those things... You know when Quentin Tarantino made the Grindhouse movies, right?
Yeah.
There's a genre of Grindhouse movies. Some of them are interesting, some of them aren't very good at all. But so he said, oh, let's do it again and let's make them look like rubbishy old Grindhouse movies. Oh, how incredibly clever, Quentin. It's funny, most of us saw the films the first time around, don't really need you to do it. In the case of Viva, there's a very strange sense of this again. For the first 5 minutes, you think that's a very, very accurate representation of those tacky, cheesy 70s sex comedies. Everyone laughs out of context. Everyone acts really badly. Everyone's dressed in a particularly sort of 70s Bri Nylon kind of way. People sit on chairs that clearly weren't meant for sitting on. But you know what? 5 minutes in, the joke wears thin. 10 minutes in, you think, I've seen enough bad 70s sex comedies to not have to sit through one that's a postmodern pastiche which doesn't have the sex in it, and actually after 10 minutes doesn't have the comedy in it either. It's not a terrible film. It's certainly done with love and affection, and I am assured that it tips its hat towards Russ Meyer and Herschel Gordon Lewis, although frankly I don't remember any of the Meyer or Herschel Gordon Lewis's movie being quite that long and dull. It's 2 hours long. It's at very most a 70-minute joke. Actually, it's a 10-minute joke. Even at 70 minutes, it'd be stretched. But at 2 hours, it's really sorely stretched.
Av, nicely done.
Thank you.
And brief. Mike Garvey, dear Carison Kinderman, I thought I'd drop you a line about Charlie Kaufman's new film, which is called
Synecdoche, New York,
which I saw a few weeks ago. There's a fine performance from Philip Seymour Hoffman, fantastic visual style that blurs the line between reality and imagination. But it's a big but. It's so boring. I haven't seen a film so ponderously tedious in years. It's 2 hours long, but it felt at least five. I think I may have fallen asleep somewhere in the middle, but it's so boring. I really can't tell for sure. Recommended for insomniacs, but for everyone else, avoid this self-indulgent load of twaddle.
The one thing I want to say, and it is important, is despite the fact that it's incredibly boring and incredibly self-indulgent, it is one of those utter failures in which I still respect the people who made it. I still think that it was made with ambition and a desire to do something that was inventive, but it absolutely demonstrates that Charlie Kaufman works best when collaborating with somebody else. And if he and Michel Gondry, you know, are on speaking terms, they should get back together and work together again, because they did great work together. And I still am a huge fan of his, but boy, the film's a bore.
We've already done a couple of the low rent ones, which might turn up at, you know, screen 7 and screen 34.
So however, he's not low rent.
What I suspect is going to be on your top screen at your local flea pit is going to be the next movie to be discussed by the Good Doctor.
You see, we should review this in the manner of Dan Brown. Hello, I am Mark Kermode, a reviewer for BBC Radio 5. And then you go, BBC Radio 5? Isn't that the popular listening station on AM? I go, yes, it is, Simon.
On digital and online.
It is, Simon, who I've been friends with for quite some time and have known and worked together with for 15 years. It is a digital broadcasting station also available on the computer and the intranet. And then you pick up new
right, so every so conversation has to explain who we are and why we're doing what we're doing.
Yeah, and also, everyone has to say everything out loud, even in the novel. See, one of the most amazing things about The Da Vinci Code was I thought that, you know, the problem of everyone explaining, because basically, here's the way The Da Vinci Code goes. People run into rooms, stand still, point at things and explain the plot to each other. And then they run off some more, and then they stand still and they point at some other things and they explain the plot to each other some more. And then Sir Ian McKellen turns up and then he does some pointing, and then they point at some other things, and then they explain everything, then they run a little bit more, and then it turns out that Audrey Tautou, oh, hello, I am so French, oh, 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 is in fact the last descendant of the bloodline of Christ, and everyone gets annoyed except for the people who are taking the box office.
You have just given it away then.
No, that was for The Da Vinci Code.
I realise that.
Yeah, believe me, if you haven't seen The Da Vinci Code, you don't want to. If you have seen The Da Vinci Code, you already know what I just told you. And everyone knows that's the plot of The Da Vinci Code, because it was the headline that followed The Da Vinci Code around. Oh, Audrey Tautou is the chosen one. Between Audrey Tautou and Eric Cantona of the French people in us. Anyway, never mind. So, in the case of Angels and Demons, there's a radical reinvention of the old formula. And the radical reinvention this time is that they run and explain things at the same time.
Do they point when they get there, or do they point as they're running?
No, they point as they're running, because they run and point and explain things at the same time. Because clearly there was a board meeting in which somebody said, you know, this standing around pointing and explaining things, everybody in their review said that that wasn't very good, but they liked the running a little bit more. So let's run, but we have to explain things. Because now, if you read the novel of The Da Vinci Code, Dan Brown is brilliant. It's like nobody has ever explained to him the principle of the internal monologue. So even in the novels, the characters say out loud everything that's going on in their head. People will be alone in rooms and say, I feel thirsty, I need to have a cup of tea, I'm going to sit down in a chair. A chair is a useful invention, invented, as we know, incidentally, to accommodate the kitchen table that was invented by Jesus in The Passion of the Christ, in that comedy scene that was... And it literally go on like that for hours and hours in the book. So when they take to the film, they have to carry on doing the same thing. Now, so firstly, running and explaining at the same time, major invention. Second major invention, Tom Hanks had a haircut, because even he clearly had realised that the mullet of Dr. Robert Dingy Dong wasn't going to work for the second film. Now, there's a question about whether it's a prequel or a sequel. In this case, it's a sequel, although apparently the book was done as a prequel. I haven't read Angels and Demons, the book, and frankly, I'm not going anywhere near a Dan Brown book after getting 40 pages into Da Vinci Code and thinking, I don't think I've ever read anything worse written than this. But in the case of Angels and Demons, the movie, let me tell you right now, it is the stupidest film I can remember seeing, and I'm including in that Exorcist to the Heretic. As a theological
sex,
thriller...
Sex, Lives and the Potato Man?
No, that's not stupid. That's a bunch of other things. But it's, you know, but I mean, just in terms of its utter stupidity, it is intergalactically stupid. It's a plot that was clearly left over from Star Trek, which is that there is some antimatter which has been stolen and is in a tube. And the antimatter is being held in the tube, presumably by dilithium crystals, which cannot take it anymore because they've gone through a void in the time-space continuum. And they've been buried somewhere in the Vatican City. Meanwhile, a new pope is being decided upon. So there's a race against the clock to find the antimatter, which will rip a hole in the time-space continuum and basically nuke Vatican City, and ought to see where they can do that before the Pope gets elected, which they're doing at the same time. Don't let me explain the plot on my own. I have two clips for you. Here's a bit of Tom Hanks explaining the plot.
Is it Raphael?
The chapel is Raphael, but the sculptures are Bernini. The unknown Illuminati master, Bernini?
He worked for the church.
Almost exclusively. But the Illuminati were infiltrators. There wasn't a powerful organization on Earth they didn't penetrate, including the Vatican, by hiding in plain sight. Habakkuk and the angel.
He's the prophet that predicted the annihilation of the Earth.
Let angels guide thee on thy lofty quest. This is the first marker. The path is alive.
See, bear in mind, these are people who are meant to know about this subject, but they feel the need to say out loud everything to each other every single moment, just in case the people in the back aren't getting it. I mean,
I find it quite helpful to have the plot explained very basically, as if I'm stupid.
There are conversations that literally consist of, we're in the Vatican. The Vatican, the head of the Catholic Church, that's correct. The head of the Catholic Church, the Pope. The Pope is just there. Really? So they'll have to have a new, and they'll do it. So, everything explained. Now what has to happen is Tom has to run from one church to another over a four-hour period because a priestly person is going to be killed every 4 hours before, at approximately midnight, and I say approximately midnight because it's one of those plot devices in which they say the battery for the antimatter will probably run out approximately midnight. But then we have a nail-biting seconds away from midnight. I love it when they do that. It's like in that film, the kidnap film recently. Somebody's been kidnapped. How long have we got? 13 hours. Because for exactly 13 hours, nothing will happen, and then it'll be the who's driving the boat question. So he has to run from church to church, and it'll be like 8 o'clock. Found the next clue. The next clue is there's a statue pointing camply that way. We must run that way. And then cut to 8:57 and a half, running into another room, finding another... Oh, just slightly too late. Another way, here's another symbol here. There's a painting with somebody who looks a bit strange, pointing over. Let's run that way. We must run.
And meanwhile, this is all delivered as Eddie Izzard.
While we're running and explaining at the same time, okay, while all that is happening, meanwhile, the thing is ticking away on the antimatter. Now, I thought at first, there's an interesting thing going on in the antimatter, because you know the antimatter, you know recently the Large Hadron Collider, when they turned it on, everyone said it's going to end the world. Of course it didn't, but there was all the conversation
most people
about,
said it wasn't going to.
Yes, and it did. And in fact, all that happened was they turned it on, it, you know, somebody's fuse blew out and you weren't able to make a cup of tea for a minute. But there was an interesting discussion about that, about the God particle, you know, the Higgs boson.
Yes, Higgs
right,
boson.
Higgs
yep.
boson, fine. So, obviously, they've latched onto this Higgs boson, God particle, making the antimatter thing. If the thing blows up, there will be an explosion of light. Let there be light, everything will be consumed
Fiat
in light.
Fiat Lux.
Yes, Fiat Lux, who were a strange little post-punk band, weren't they? It was also the name of a car, but they were a post-punk band. But at no point...
That's not why I mentioned it. It's obviously Latin for
let there be light.
Light.
I know.
I mentioned that.
At no point does anybody do the Lucifer light-bearer thing, which seemed to me to be the thing that was, you know, calling out.
How would that have worked?
Well, because Lucifer is the bearer of light, and therefore the explosion of antimatter, which is the, you know, you, I mean, I'm sorry, I could now write for you.
Why would antimatter explode, by the way?
Oh, because the dilithium crystals cannot take it anymore, no. Captain. Exactly. Okay. Why would antimatter explode? Why would it be in a test tube? Why would it be buried under the Vatican? Yeah. Why would any of this be happening? Why would the people who've done it, who are the Illuminati, let there be light, light Illuminati, see how they did that? Very,
are you
very clever.
You're saying it's not a true story?
I'm saying not only is it not a true story, it's a story that's so Thunderbirds that there is a moment in it when... I'm going to play you another clip.
Oh, good.
This is a clip of Ewan McGregor, okay? I want you to tell me, on the basis of this clip, where he's from.
Okay.
The battle is well underway, signori. We must defend ourselves. But what if this time we fight their stealth with openness, combat their wicked scheme with simple truth, and end this brutish battle once and for all? If the outside world could see this church as I do, looking beyond the ritual of these walls, they would see a modern miracle. A brotherhood of imperfect, simple souls who want nothing more than to be voices of compassion in a world spinning out of control. Signori, I ask, I pray that you break this conclave. Open the doors. Evacuate St. Peter's Square and tell the world the truth.
Where's he from? Where's he from? Where's he doing? What accent's that?
I would say it's probably... Well, he's probably grown up with Simon Pegg doing Scotty and then spent a holiday in Venice.
Yeah, no, neither of the above. Well, right, so honestly, open up to this. Tell us what accent Ewan McGregor was doing there. Well, I mean, it's a key plot point as to why he's doing the accent.
Well, it's clearly Scottish.
No.
Well, it is.
No, but it isn't.
Yeah, but it is.
No, but that's because he is, in fact, Scottish, although he's meant to be in the Vatican. But no, shall I tell you what it's meant to be?
Well, no, not if you've just opened it up to text.
Open it up
email.
To this as what accent is Ewan doing there? Anyway, so...
If I've read the book, have I got an unfair advantage?
Probably, but I don't know, because I mean,
there
I haven't
are
read
no
the
prizes
book.
For this.
There'll be a moment in the book in which he explains where he's from, exactly as he does in the film. He stands up and explains where he's from. And I was going, well, thank heaven for that, because frankly, Ewan, I couldn't place your accent. Anyway, there's a moment very early on when Ewan, in that voice, declares... into nothing at all, that he has a pilot's license and can fly helicopters. And I'm going, literally, okay, fine, 20 minutes in. I wonder how long it'll be before Ewan has to get into a helicopter and fly it.
I wonder whether, having gone north, south, east, and west,
whether at some point we are going to go down and then up. There is... The first hour is as boring as ever, even though they're doing the running and explaining with the less bad haircut. The little bit after that, snore-inducingly bad. But the last 40 minutes are laugh-out-loud funny, and I guarantee if Gerry Anderson had come up with that plot for, you know, for Thunderbirds or something, he would have torn the place up. The skydiving implications of it are so staggering. I mean, with that, I don't want to give away... It's, in a way, I want to tell you what happens in the end, because the end is so funny.
No, well, you can't.
I can't.
That, no.
But the end is so funny. When you go and see the film, and people will go and see the film, people will see it in their droves.
I will go and see the film.
Tell me if you don't laugh at the revelation moment. I mean, I sat there and I was genuinely... It was like that Monty Python thing about as if you've been hit by a wet fish. The great revelation, let there be light, I've got a helicopter pilot's license, it's all coming together, and the clock's ticking moment was staggering. A couple of other things to point out. I love to see Armin Mullerstahl in these films, because whenever they want somebody who's non-specifically European, get Armin Mullerstahl. Nobody knows where he's from. He just talks in a voice that's vaguely European. Let's get him. Is he busy? No, let's get him in. Also, only Ron Howard could have directed the following two sequences as action sequences. Firstly, a trip to the Vatican Library, which turns into a nail-biting action sequence, only without the nail-biting. And secondly, the announcement of a new pope. You know how they announce a new pope? Smoke up the chimney?
Yes, white
smoke. Ron does the smoke going up the chimney as an action sequence. It's Mission Impossible goes to the Vatican with some Star Trek and Thunderbirds thrown in for good measure. It is stupid in ways that you could not possibly imagine. And the final word on it was... Obviously, it tries to embrace the Catholic Church in a way that the Da Vinci Code didn't, because there's, you know, many millions of dollars to be made out there by not getting on the wrong side of the biggest religion in the world, or one of the biggest religions in the world. So, consequently, they've kind of worked it so the Catholic Church kind of comes out of it all right, and there's nothing to be offended by. But one Catholic paper took against it without having seen it and wrote a review saying it's evil and terrible, to which somebody wrote a counter-review which said, "You are a man of great faith. You believe, though you have not seen." And that is a funnier joke than anything that's in the film.
Ewan's accent, various suggestions. Mexican.
Nope.
Is Ewan a Scot trying to be Irish after 5 years in Australia? From Ben. Ewan is doing laid-back Klingon. Brian from Martin. Esperanto. Rich in...
William Shatner.
Mandarin. Is it Spanish, Irish, Italian, Reese in Essex? Dear Prudence, please could you repeat how stupid Angels and Demons is, as my housemate was boiling the kettle.
It is stupider than the very stupidest thing you can imagine. It is stupider than Exodus to the Heretic. Shall I tell you where Ewan was meant to be from?
Yes.
He's Northern Irish, mate. He's
no,
grown up.
No,
listen.
Not.
I'm Northern Irish, mate. I've grown up in the Troubles. That's why I talk like an Australian. That's how I've ended up where I'm here. I've had all this history. You know, I'm just throwing the net a little bit wider. That was Ewan doing Northern Irish.
Well, Ian Onions in Charlton was his character, the Belfast-raised son of a Turkish kebab shop owner, which which is about as close as it's going to get. Last week we announced our next trip to the Cineworld in Edinburgh is going to be on the 19th of June. We gave away our first batch of tickets. They've all gone. They went within a couple of minutes or something like that. They're going to be given away in batches. As a way of prolonging the agony. The second,
no, Simon, as a way of being more fair.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. Of course. Sorry, you've been on the course. 22nd of May is when the next batch go away. Is that a couple of weeks now?
I don't know.
It's next week.
Is it?
Next Friday is when the next batch will go away. We'll give you more details. If you want to come to our next Wittertainment live show, it's going to be Cineworld in Edinburgh on the 19th of June. On the subject of angels and demons, yes. Just some correspondence before we get on to Fighting.
Go ahead.
Nick in Rochdale.
Not Fighting, a film called Fighting.
That's right. Nick in Rochdale, dear Robert and Victoria, took myself along to see Angels and Demons, as I'm on study leave, you see. As a fan of the book, I had high hopes, and they were largely met. It's much better than The Da Vinci Code, not least because the book is, and even had a faint whiff of a possibility of being almost realistic at
times. Oh, come on!
Stop. Some of the characters differ from those in the book, and it would have been done better if, for example, the assassin, as he's known in the book, because assassin comes from hashish, so therefore is that's why it is.
Well, he's like, hey man, I've got to like kill you, but I just got to, you know, score some other stuff.
It's was allowed
really
to display his
day.
Darker side more. As far as action movies go, he's definitely up there in the higher strata and absolutely worth seeing. If only the Manchester University Ancient History Department had lecturers like Robert Langdon.
Yeah.
Justin in Oadby, after having watched Angels and Demons last night, I can honestly state that I have never been so disappointed in a film release. Being a great fan of Dan Brown, despite the occasionally snooty comments, where would you have heard those, Justin, about his style and storylines, I eagerly look forward to this production. But a combination of wooden acting, adjustment of the original storyline, omission of characters from the novel, and an obsession with replacing intrigue with action left me feeling
action,
hollow.
Action, 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 action. They can't do anything without action.
John in Bradford, firstly, that's a congratulations thing there. I went to see Angels and Demons last night. Terrible film based on a terrible novel. The film seemed to be a collection of the highlights of the book joined together by car chases. Major details of the story were missed out. Tom Hanks' character worked everything out in seconds, and then they jumped in
and
a police
explained
car
it.
And went to the next place. There were Italian policemen with American accents. Wasn't sure until Ewan McGregor said where he was from, where he was supposed to be from.
Exactly.
It was rubbish of the highest order.
There is an awful lot of zipping across town in a car, whereas if you ever tried to zip across town around the Vatican in a car, you know it's not possible to move.
Sally says, I'm glad everything has been explained. We're taking our 13-year-old son. Can we treat the film as an RE lesson, and can it count towards coursework?
No, but can I say on the subject of taking a 13-year-old son that the film is a 12A, and as you probably know, it was altered at rough cut stage. The BBFC suggested, I'm quoting from their website, the sight of blood splattering onto a character's face, a character screaming in pain as he burns, a sight of a wound being injected, and a character self-immolating should all be reduced for a 12A. Just so you know,
what
that's what you get.
So what else is new? Should I want to not go and see Angels and Demons?
Well, shall we do Fighting, since you did, I keep wanting to say Stockard Channing.
Channing Tatum.
Yes. So Fighting. Should we have a clip of Fighting? I mean, the plot of it is Channing Tatum
fights.
He gets into a fight. He's a street kid. He gets his stuff nicked. He goes to find the guy who nicked his stuff. The guy says, "You could be a fighter." Here's a clip.
Can I help you? Come on. Look, I want my money back. Okay.
What money are you talking about?
You know what I'm talking about.
Look, I don't mean no.
Come on.
He took it.
No,
okay,
he did
and I
not
want it back right now.
He took
it's
your
same
money.
Shirt and everything.
Okay. How much are we talking about?
No, ask
how
her.
Much are we, hey, that's not nice.
Thank you very much.
I should call the police on
you.
You
should.
You know that's that?
Exactly what you should do. I'll wait here for you if you want. You know, you shouldn't be robbing people, you know that? Especially ones that can come and find you.
Why don't you sit down and talk to me for a second? I just want to have a conversation with you. You know, that was some show you put on out there today. In the streets, you know, the fisticuff thing. Look, I'm Harvey Borden, all right? Let me introduce myself. I'm Harvey Borden.
Sean MacArthur.
Good to meet you. You like to fight?
If I have to.
I can make you $5,000.
One of those early introduction sequences.
But the funny thing about the film, and then what happens is he says, I can make him $5,000. You have a fight, he has a fight, he wins one, he has another fight, maybe not win, he has another fight, he's told to lose it. So there's a standout. The funny thing is that in many ways, though, that's a very straightforward, generic, you know, street fighting action movie, and there are, you know, fighting scenes in it. But it's directed by Dieter Bontilho, who did that thing, The Guide to Recognizing Your Saints, which was a kind of semi-autobiographical tale of him growing up in and around New York, which had a real kind of earthy quality.
I think we spoke to him about that.
Yeah, and it was easily the best thing that your man who then went on to star in Transformers had ever done. What's his name? The guy's name I can't even remember now. He's such a dull actor. You know, that guy, his name, he's in the Indiana Jones, and I can never pronounce his name. Him. Anyway, well, he's good in The Guide to Recognizing a Saint. And funnily enough, Little Bits of Fighting, I don't know what you thought about it, Little Bits of Fighting reminded me of Saturday Night Fever, that you have the dance sequences, which are the fight sequences, but then you have the gritty, earthy stuff around it, and that gritty, earthy stuff is done fairly well. I mean, it's not anything like as verbally explicit as Saturday Night Fever was, and it's nothing like as good. It's a movie that's going to come and go quite quickly. But it wasn't unlikable in that you did have a sense of these characters genuinely having lives. Some of the interaction between them was genuinely quite interesting. I think Terrence Howard, I mean Terrence Howard, don't I? Yeah, who was last seen most famously in Well, It's Hard Out Here for a Pimp, does that incredibly laid-back performance rather well. And the idea that he's just this kind of this street hustler who's not all gabbly, but is, as you heard there, he sort of talks like he's a little bit, sounds a little bit stoned, although he's not actually, that's not what he's meant to be, he's just meant to be laid-back. I found his character likable, and every moment that he was on screen, I thought, I'm quite interested in this. Channing Tatum himself, I think, is a perfectly fine screen presence. I mean, he's obviously he's got a beefcake thing going on, but he's...
looks good in a vest, I think is the phrase you're looking for.
Yeah, no, he does look good in a vest, and I've got... Actually, I have no problem with him, you know, trading on that, because he has does have some acting chops, and I think he does do the role of the. Funnily enough,
what do acting chops look like?
Well, they're you
know, spot those.
They're when somebody does. I tell you, you know what Julian Sands looks like.
Yes.
The opposite of that, okay? But sorry, I was going to finish on that point. I think there is a strange sort of street charm about fighting. Yes, obviously it's a nuts and bolts exploitation bit with, you know, with fights in it, and the story is fairy tale, the story you could map out on a napkin before the movie starts, you know exactly how it's going to work out. But I thought it had a certain charm. Did you like it at all?
I did. Well, I did, and I thought Channing Tatum was, I mean, because as part
of seems
the,
like a lovely guy, doesn't he?
Part of the prep, I was made to watch Step Up, which I hadn't, yeah. I hadn't seen, and, you know, the Saturday Night Fever thing presumably comes and the fact that he's a fantastic dancer,
yes,
as well as being a pretty impressive fighter.
Yeah,
I mean, I thought he was. It made me almost interested in G.I. Joe, actually, because he's got a big part in that.
Yeah, so. But I like him. I think he's a decent screen presence. I think Terrence Howard does well in the film. Like I said, in the end, it's a B-movie. It's a fluffy B-movie. But Dieter Montilla has actually got some visual style. And it's odd because it's two different movies, but together they make quite a passable package.
Shia LaBeouf.
Shia LaBeouf.
Shia LaBeouf.
Shia LaBeouf. Him. He was okay in
The
Guide to Sheila LaBeouf in
The
Guide to Recognizing Your Saints, and then he got into the robots hitting each other things, and then he was the annoying one in Indiana Jones. With
squeeze
the...
and quick 90-second there out of something. French
Can
film?
Can we very quickly do French film? Yeah, again, you had the star of French film.
Well, one of them, yeah. Douglas Henschel was on yesterday, and then annoyingly just found out he was in about three cinemas and only in London.
Yeah, so the story is two couples, neither apparently made ideally for each other. Eric Cantona is a French film director. At the beginning of it, our hero is seen watching an interview with him. He's got to interview him. I think he's got to interview him for Sight and Sound. And he doesn't believe in the romantic French version of love. Have we got time for a clip?
How
Eric Cantona.
Clip?
Should we play 20 seconds of Eric Cantona?
Go on.
Here we go.
I'm going to go and make some coffee. Love is the only significant event in the life of a human being. He must achieve it at all costs. The ones who do not cannot say that he have lived.
He's definitely having a wee at the same time.
No, he's not
there.
Doing it. He's on the television. The other people, the English people,
they're having a wee.
While Eric is talking about. So the whole thing is the French, oi, hoi, 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 Galois, yes, coffee, gitan, blah, 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 where the English, oh, hello, I'm very uptight and not having any good fun or sex or anything.
Scottish.
No, the main guy is English.
That was Dougie Henschel.
Dougie Henschel. That's not Dougie Henschel there, but that's the remnant of that.
You've got to get this right.
We've got about 20
We're
seconds
not doing
left.
Anything anymore.
You know what? It's perfectly fine. It's better written than a lot of low-budget British movies. It's not a gangsters and geezers movie, which is quite good. Every now and then it attempts to do Richard Curtis light. Every now and then it attempts to do Nora Ephron light, and those minutes it falls down. Other minutes it's quite funny. There's one very good line about the difference between racism and xenophobia is that racism is based on ignorance and xenophobia is based on knowledge. And I did laugh five or six times. If that podcast wasn't enough, visit my Uncut blog at www.bbc.co.uk/Mark Kermode for video reviews, anecdotes, and the chance to let me know your opinions.
Thanks for downloading from the BBC. To find other downloads or more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live